Hi there, podcast listeners. We have a special treat for you today, three for the price of one, which, to be clear, is always free. Former co-host of this show, my predecessor actually, Hannah Miller, joined Corey and me to contribute a very different voice, both in timbre and in political temperament, to the show. I think it's so helpful to hear a range of ideas from a range of perspectives, especially when those perspectives are thoroughly Christian. We will extensively explore the implications of legally defining abortion as murder and charging mothers with murder. I told you we'd be having this conversation often. We would love to hear from you as well. You can find us on Facebook or email us at drtonyandaustin@gmail.com. drtonyandaustin@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Good morning, everybody. Welcome into hour number two of Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. I am the aforementioned Austin Barker. I am a gardener. I've been doing it a lot lately, and it's hot lately, and it's good to be alive, and it's good to be in a straight line of descent from Adam. You know, that guy that God created, put in a garden, and said, tend my planet.
That's you, your direct descendant, I guess. I am not. I have a gray thumb. My house is Plant Hospice. It's where they come to be lovingly cared for as they die. That's all I can do for them. I would love to be a gardener. I have tried. I have a philodendron that I have kept alive, but just barely. I killed an aloe plant. I didn't know you could do that, but I did it. So, you know,
and somewhere,
that's it.
Corey, do you have any confessions you need to share with us?
And somewhere in between the two of you, the green and the gray thumb, I am confident in my 36 years of life, I've never put my hand in soil.
So, I grew up with it. My dad.
I think
had
that's
a garden,
immoral.
So.
I'm confident. I've never done an act of gardening.
I now question all of your value system. No, I'm just kidding.
I've cut the grass. I've pulled some weeds. Does that count?
You got your hands
it's in the,
dirty.
It's in the same
ways.
Category. Yeah, it is okay. In the category. So, welcome.
Well, when I was doing some house stuff during COVID, I think I just got bored and tore up all my front bushes out of the beds. Just, does that count? Did I do an act of landscaping.
Landscaping destruction, but that's the easy part.
Pour rocks out over. See, that's my version of like, you know what? I'm just going to get all the bushes, and I'm going to be like, I have a Russian neighbors who they just pour concrete right there. And I'm like, you know what? I like it.
I like that.
I want to do it. I just, let's pour concrete. And of course, then I got all my friends who are like, pull out your flowers and put vegetable garden in. And I'm like, that's awesome. If you can grow a vegetable, you know, I can't grow a vegetable.
You'll
I'm
have
sorry.
No moral credibility.
I'm really, really good at using my iPhone. Like, I have a lot of dexterity between apps.
That is not organic.
Really,
your iPhone is completely synthetic.
I'm trying to think of other skills
I keep children alive. Frequently.
I've
not lost one yet.
Okay,
so,
you're in. Join the club.
You're keeping your dog alive. That's sort of like,
I'm a medical professional.
You're not a medical professional until you try to put a shot in a 1,200-pound animal that's trying to kill you. Then you're a medical professional.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, let me just tell you, when you're in a stall in a tight space with a 1,200-pound animal that has got a needle hanging out their neck because they're mad at you, woo, buddy!
Yeah.
Let's talk then, all right?
Is that a hippo that you're talking about?
No, that was a very large horse. That was a very large chestnut mare. And if you know horses, chestnut mares are bad enough to begin with.
I have heard that. Yes, aggressive.
Yes, they are just, you know, there's a stereotype for a reason. Anyway,
all of that divergence comes because you said the word gardener.
I know. We're gardening, farming, animals, it's not too far off.
When you have three curious people in a room, and I mean curious in both senses.
That's
like,
right.
We're very curious people, and we're also very, very curious.
Fair.
NPR just put out a, I got this on my Google News. Let's see if I can pull this back up. It's interesting to me because it's what we're going to talk about. They just published, or just posted, well, it was at 5 a.m. I just saw it. An article headlined, "Much of the U.S. could criminalize abortion, but how will those laws be enforced?" So that's the interesting question that's coming down now in a post Dobbs. Now, we're just assuming de facto that the Dobbs leak is going to hold, that that's actually going to be the eventual decision. Do you want to render an opinion on that? How confident are you, I guess, that that will indeed be the decision?
I'm at 75% confident.
Yeah, when it first leaked, I was like, 30% confident.
Yeah.
I've increased that to about 60% now. We still got a few weeks to go. There's still a lot of protesting to go. There's still a lot of pressure to apply that can be applied to these guys and gals. Because remember, and I'm sure you guys have covered, this is a draft. Anything can happen. Votes can be changed. The wording. I think what's likely to find if it changes, it won't be that a vote will be changed. It'll be that the wording will be changed.
That's
they'll
right.
go in and they'll change
they'll
some
soften
of the
it.
They'll soften their the verbiage that we found in the ruling. So yeah.
the the Roberts interest will be going to Alito and saying, I'd love to give you my vote. To do that, you can't say these things about the reasoning of Roe. You can't say these things about the reasoning of Casey. You cannot, prima facie, on the face, say they were wrong, wrongly decided, because Alito does. On the face,
he
they
says,
were
we
wrong.
We believe Roe and Casey must be overturned.
Yeah, they were egregious.
But that was I mean, literally, that was what counsel brought to the oral arguments. Is that
both
the,
counsels?
Yes, they said you can't. This is an all or nothing proposition. It's either overturn or uphold. Those are your only two options, and there's no middle ground.
The Mississippi case on purpose got us to that spot to say to the Supreme Court, you must affirm Roe and Casey, or you must overturn them. There is no middle way. And I know that Roberts right now is desperately trying to find some middle way.
Yeah, he is. He's a middleman. He tries to always be. I think he views himself as some sort of like mediator, peacemaker, bridge maker.
He is.
And he's like, oh, let's try to bridge the gap between these two sides. And sometimes, and I know we've talked this morning that there really is not a, we don't live in a binary world, but some situations are binary, and this was a binary one. And he's trying to find that middle ground that just isn't there.
Not on this one.
Not on this one.
There are some things. When it comes to morality, right, wrong, and if we're just talking about including a new set of humans in the definition of human, so as to not murder them, right now we're all protected underneath the Constitution. We're just adding some new humans to the, to those protections. Kavanaugh, I could also see being the guy who says to Roberts, "Okay, let's try to find a third way together," and the decision being weakened. But I don't see any way around the Mississippi law being upheld. Roberts might be trying to find a way to not overturn Roe, but I tell you, I'm 70% there.
I'm much closer than
I was. Okay, so what's in the 30%, I guess, is wondering, what are your reservations? Is it just that one, that a justice might succumb to the public pressure? The protests would get to them?
It doesn't have to be that. It can just be Roberts' internal working. And Roberts' persuasion is simply, we have one institution left that the American people largely trust. It's the court. So don't do something that might diminish the credibility of the court in the public's eyes. That's not the court's job. The court's job is not to ensure.
And Alito said that in his opinion.
That's right. That's my 30%, is that Roberts would be effective in persuading Kavanaugh and maybe persuading Alito with this. Don't you want six votes? You don't want to do this with the narrowest of majorities. Here's how you can get me to 6-3. If Roe was decided with 7-2, it was 7-2. Or is it 6-3?
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. You're probably right.
Yeah, I think Roe was 7-2. Roberts trying to trade his vote for something more modest. But again, I'm confident, because here's what I think happens in reality with a guy like Kavanaugh. I think his confirmation process hardened him. I think he would have been more of a Roberts, but he was so jaded by his confirmation process, he looks out at the left and says, you want it? Yeah, why don't you mess around and find out? Well, after you did what you did to me, watch me do what I'll do to you. That's not good reasoning either, but no. It might have happened.
I think he'd have been hard-pressed to avoid that happening. And if he did, and if he has, and that hasn't been a motivating factor for him, kudos to him, because I would have been hard-pressed to not be like, in your eye,
yes.
Now I'm up here, and I don't like you guys. So.
After what they did to him.
Yeah, and his family.
I don't know that I had the character to not spend the rest of my career trying to make your lives miserable. But I suspect he's not doing that. He's a better man.
Well, and we've seen that because there's already been decisions that he's made that, you know, in my opinion, were wrong.
Yes.
You know, but yeah.
So I'm confident we're going to overturn Roe.
All right. So let's talk about the implications of post-Dobbs. Are the pieces of legislation, and I'm keying in particularly on legislation, though there's a strong cultural component to this too, and that's where I tend to spend my focus, is changing the hearts and minds, making abortion unnecessary for women, persuading women that you actually don't need an abortion to live the best, to live your best life. But there is a political component. There is a legal component to this. And so let's key in there for just a minute and ask, the first question is that political dynamic going to look different in purple states versus red states? We know what blue states are going
to
do. They're going to legalize abortion, okay?
And they're probably going to
go. They're probably going
to
go further than Roe went.
Yeah. They're going to say, we're going to fund it.
So they're what they are. We don't really have a lot of tug over that.
Yeah.
Okay. So what about in purple states, and maybe let's start with South Carolina and what happens in red states?
I think we're going to straight up do what Oklahoma did, right? We're going to have an abortion ban, except for maybe it'll go rape, incest, life of the mother. We might just do life of the mother. I lean there.
I think so. I think it's still going to be a little bit of a battle, because we might be a red state, but we're the purplest red state. And I think that that's and just our legislators, and we've already have some that are Republican that are kind of hemming and hawing on some of that. And so
what is hemming and hawing sound like? What are those arguments that you're hearing? And I'm not saying that you need to name names or even what are the arguments?
I think the three that you just mentioned, the rape, incest, life of the mother, those are the exceptions that everybody wants to, you know, kind of find in the middle ground. And I think none of them have a leg to stand on as a mother and understanding science and motivation and blah, 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 blah. And we don't have to get into all of that. I don't think any of them have a leg to stand on. But there's a lot of Republicans out there who think that that's the middle ground for them. And that's what they want to embrace. And so I think that that could possibly be where we end up landing. And I don't even know if we've got the cajones to say everything but life of the mother here. I would love to have everything banned. I don't even know if we've got maybe we do. Maybe now that we're here where we are, the middle ground might be life of the mother. Maybe because here's the thing with the abortion debate and the pro-life debate, the situation has changed and adapted over the 50 years, 60 years now that we've been having this debate. It's moved, and where the middle ground used to be is where the middle ground is no longer. And we may find that the middle ground is now going to be life of the mother.
The practical effect of an abortion ban except for rape, incest, life of the mother is an abortion ban, because the rape and incest abortions happen so rarely, you have effectively banned abortion.
I'm gonna try to bring up the statistics on that because I've got it saved right here on what the actual, you know, the latest data from I always forget how to say it.
Guttmacher Institute.
And oh yeah, here it is. But anyway, go ahead. You were gonna make a
while point. You find that stat. Mm-hmm. What will red states do? I think local go from what Oklahoma did, which is an absolute ban. Period. Bottom line, ranging to 6-week bans, except for rape, incest, life of the mother. That's the range of possibilities in red states. Purple states, it's going to be war.
Well, I think you've got you also had Louisiana that recently tried to pass a criminalization. So
talk
I think
that
that's going
that.
To be
the
I think that'll be a that's going to be a part of the discussion too.
Maybe that's the other
is
end.
Here's the statistics though. Is you've got 0.001% of pregnancy resulted from an incestuous relationship.
That's
and this
one
is
out of
where
a thousand.
This is the latest abortion data. And so this is women who came in and they said this is the reason that I'm having an abortion. Right. And that's 0.001% incestuous relationship. 0.065% the woman's life was endangered by the pregnancy. 0.085% the woman was raped. 0.288% the woman's physical health was threatened by the pregnancy. 0.294% the woman's psychological health was threatened by the pregnancy. 0.666% there was a serious fetal abnormality. 6.268% the woman aborted for social or economic reasons. 92.330% no reason. This was elective. This is birth control for me.
That's right.
So you're right. You know, and this is one of those things that we the pro-lifers now have in our toolbox when we talk about being updated on the issues, knowing where they're going to go, knowing the arguments and knowing how to defend our arguments and our opinions. This is one of the number one ways that we can do it is these things are so, you know, the rape, incest and life of the mother are the very tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of what's happening. And so do we make laws accommodating for that tiny, tiny, tiny percentage? And as my dad say, regarding the entire Roe versus Wade situation, is hard cases make for bad laws. Those are hard cases and they make for bad laws.
Absolutely. People be making exceptions out of or rules out of exceptions all the time. You know, as soon as you say, let's ban abortion, they're like, but what about? And then they trot out these small, minuscule cases. Now, listen, when you multiply those numbers out, okay, over the scope of the problem that we're talking about, you're talking about a good number of women who fit into those hard case scenarios.
Yeah, sure.
If we adopt a bad law or a law that can be applied badly, then those stories are going to make frontline news. Those stories are just going to be on parade, frontline headline parade for the next however many years.
Right. Well,
until
it's every time you want to talk about health care, you know, single payer health care. Every time you want to talk about abortion. Every time you want to talk about border control. Any of those. Any policy issue whatsoever. The leftists trot out some kind of sob story that's typically a very tiny percentage
of
what's actually happening. They try to, and that's actually one of the reasons I don't talk personally a lot about why I'm personally invested in the formula shortage is because, look, it's my the my personal and what's going on and the emotionalism of that is irrelevant. Let's talk about the policies that are making this a disaster. Let's talk about the policies that are making my life miserable, because that's where what it comes down to is the policy issues. And we, the leftists and our young people, are so caught up in emotionalism and the emotionalism of these small percentages that we don't look at the totality of the policies.
Progressives have perfected the art of the sob story. And so we, though, as a pro-life movement, have become much better at telling pro-life stories. We have and I'll just say Tim Tebow, okay, it illustrates a much broader trend within the pro-life movement of telling the stories of people who were abortion vulnerable, mm-hmm. survived.
Steph Curry.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
His mom admitted this week she was going to abort
him. Is that right?
Yeah, and then she didn't.
Wow. So but knowing, excuse me.
Go ahead.
But knowing that policy affects real people, how do you prioritize people in your policy without compromising principle?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it comes at a little bit of this comes back to the question of, you know, when I was in college, I had a friend who he didn't want to have anything to do with politics because he was just like, what does it matter? I'm just a flea on a dog, and they don't care. The dog doesn't care what the flea thinks. And so his perspective was, why should I be involved at all? And I was kind of like, well, what happens when the dog decides to take a flea bath? Now you're affected, you know? And so the reality is that we care. And so his whole premise was, I don't care about politics because it doesn't, you know, yeah, it affects me, but it just... my voice doesn't matter, I guess. And of course, I was like, well, we're a constitutional republic. It does matter, first of all. First things first. But second, we care about politics because we care about policy, because we care about people. Because you see, politics creates policy, and policy affects people. And I think it's Ally Stuckey has some sort of pithy way that she says it. I don't remember what it is. But it's very true. And so when you're talking about, you know, why do I care so much about these policies? And why should we care about so much about these policies in politics is because people matter. And those babies, their lives matter. And so when we're looking at this and we're talking about the whole situation and we want to care, you know what? They try to tell you that those who are pro-life, they just care about the baby. They don't care about women. They don't care about families. You've never been to a crisis pregnancy center, have you? You've never walked through those doors and seen the formula and the diapers and the clothes and the parenting classes and the financial classes, the things that the marriage counseling that they do. Planned Parenthood offers you one thing. You can have an abortion here.
Right.
You walk into a CPC and you can get an ultrasound for free. You can get a pregnancy test for free. You can get diapers and formula and clothes and counseling and all kinds of help for free. And they're just there to help you. And so when it comes to policies, when it comes to pro-lifers, we can say we can have very strict policy. We can care for people. And it's one of the things, and I'll just get to the heart of the matter here, and I think this is where we disagree, is the criminalization of abortion. And because how do you criminalize something and care for the women who are affected by
that's such a great question.
I think that that's where... The problem lies. That's where the crux of the matter is.
Mm-hmm.
And so my opening statement for that, I guess, would be that when murder is wrong, we all agree murder is wrong, and there should be penalty for murder. No exceptions. The difference between Ghana and the United States and our justice system and so many judicial systems across the world is what? Due process. If you've got a 15-year-old that's been kept in a basement by their uncle for 2 years and is starving to death and breaks out and goes to a store and steals a loaf of bread, is stealing wrong?
Yes.
Yes, stealing is wrong. That child gets taken up before a judge. I would expect that judge to be, no charges. I mean, and then we should drag the uncle out there and throw the book at him.
Right.
That's what we would do. And so when you're talking about these terrible situations where, I mean, let's go back to the statistics. The vast majority of these women are getting an abortion because of birth control. They know
Definitely. Exactly
what they're doing.
That's right.
There's a very small number of women who are in the crisis situations that we would have sympathy for.
And that the vast majority of women know that they're killing another human.
Yes. And so
there's this misportrayal,
mm-hmm.
and I don't have data and I don't have a source. I have an mm-hmm. intuition, mm-hmm. okay? That we want to give women a lot more credit than I think they deserve, that they are just conducting a moral...
We want to give them a lot more leniency.
We're conducting a moral cost-benefit analysis. They are conducting a moral cost-benefit analysis, and they say, carrying this pregnancy to term is going to harm me in this and this and this ways, and I don't want that to suffer that harm, so I'm willing to kill another human in order to... Because it's a marginal human. It's a potential human. And we put all these qualifiers on it and say, I'm willing to do that in order to get this good end.
So how do you... But the reality still is that there are situations that are heartbreaking, and there are girls who have they've been lied to, they've been deceived, they don't know exactly what they're doing. They're the young, they're the vulnerable. How do we protect those women? That 1 or 2%, it's not even 1 or 2% really, but how do we protect those women when we're talking about criminalizing abortion? And that's where due process comes into play. And if you say, well, I don't trust our justice system to appropriately adjudicate that kind of situation, well, then your problem is with our justice system, and you got a bigger fish to fry here. Right. It's not with saying murder is murder, stealing is stealing. We have all kinds of... Look, I was in City Hall just last week, and I had gotten a ticket because the sticker wasn't on my car for my insurance, and the cop couldn't pull it up on his computer. I had paid it. I had just forgotten to put the sticker on. And so he said, look, come in and I'll have, you know, just bring your receipt, show proof, and we'll drop the charges, but you got to come in. So I went in, I showed my receipt, they dropped the charges. Like, they do this kind of thing. Judges know how to look at, you know, it's not one size fits all. That's why we have due process. It's why we have the judicial system that we have, is so that when these kinds of situations come up, we can protect the vulnerable, and we can punish those in wrongdoing.
Again, my intuition tells me that those difficult situations are going to be greater than 2%.
They're going to be greater than 2%?
I think so. I think that's my intuition, is that we'll be dealing with, I don't know what percentage to put on it, but my intuition is that it's up there, that there's going to be a lot of these cases. So I guess, and I have four or five questions. Let's start with what is the appropriate criminal penalty for a mother who aborts her baby?
Well, I think the vast majority of criminal punishment should go to the abortion, whoever commits the abortion.
I don't think we'll have any disagreement on that.
Yeah, and I think that this is where the justice system has to come into play, because you have to look at a variance. You have to talk about, okay, is it going to be a year in jail? Is it going to be $10,000? I think that's what Louisiana had. I think it was $10,000 or a year in prison.
That's right.
Let's pause there for a second. Is that the appropriate penalty for an abortion-minded woman? Does that serve the woman? Because this is more of a punitive justice or a reformative justice?
Well, I think your question, really what we're getting into when you're talking about all of this, is does our justice system serve those that need justice and those who don't? Because you're really getting into a broader conversation here, because there's a lot of situations here in the United States of America where I think we have a wonderful justice system, but we don't, you know, the war on drugs. Let's just take that for example.
Right.
The war on drugs, you know, you've got people who are going... It does the war on drugs and some of our punishments for those who get caught doing drugs, does it serve them?
Absolutely not.
So really, we're talking about an issue with our justice system and how we adjudicate things, not with the criminalization of abortion.
And so let's not put a criminalization of mothers into a badly informed justice system. Let's not say... You've already demonstrated that your interest is not to serve people. It's to punish people.
So then how do you differentiate, though, between murder is murder, that's a baby, that's murder, but in your circumstance, we're going to allow it. Well, then why don't we allow... We say, well, you can steal and it's wrong for you to steal, but as long as... So then you have to start having exceptions, I think, across the board for difficult situations.
Corey. Do you need criminal exceptions or sentencing exceptions where we give judges leeway? I mean, we call it what it is.
Call it murder. Definitional.
Yes.
We need a definitional law that abortion is murder, because all three of us agree with that.
Abortion is not a different category than murder. It's just a mess.
It's the taking of an innocent life. That's nothing other than murder.
Yeah,
but
sure.
In this category, the same way we give judges leeway on sentencing for drug crime, we can give judges leeway on sentencing for this category of murder?
Well, I mean, don't we with everything? Don't they have some sort of leniency and some sort of bandwidth, I guess, for lack of a better word, for pretty much everything? I mean, you've got people who go to jail for 30 years for murder, and you've got people who go to jail for 1 year for murder.
It's a prudential decision based on the aggravating circumstances.
They get off with time served.
Right.
So that kind of thing would apply most certainly to this
kind
of thing.
Can we build that flexibility into a murder charge against an abortive mother?
I think so.
I think you can, but the reality is it does come down to a judge, and it comes down to them. And that's where the United States, the citizens of the United States have to be very engaged with who are your judges.
Right.
Are they adjudicating things rightly and justly? Are we paying attention to those kinds of things? Here in South Carolina, every state do it differently, how judges are elected.
Mm-hmm. We do it very badly.
The
worst in the world.
The worst in the world we do, or in the United States at least. Yeah. We do it the worst. And we need reform with that.
The judges aren't the only thing that matters. The law that we craft has to give the judges the leeway that they need to make a prudential decision in how they sentence the mother, the aborted mother.
I don't know if you have to put it, I mean, yeah, you could put it into the phrasing of your bill. You certainly could do that. I don't know if it's entirely necessary.
Murder is a capital crime.
Yeah, murder.
I mean, are we going to sentence them to the death penalty for murder?
Especially I think if you've got eight women who, I mean, if you could, I think if you've got a woman who's aborted her child eight times, yep. I mean, eight children, done it eight times. She's fully aware, and a judge rules that she was completely aware that this was a human being, and she has murdered eight people.
Again, if we are going to put abortion inside the category of murder,
right?
All of the potential punishments for murder have to be available.
Yeah.
But you can, I believe state legislatures do this constantly. They're the ones who set sentencing guidelines. Mm-hmm. State legislatures tell judges.
Well, a law can do that. I don't know if we do that routinely, but a law can do that.
Mm-hmm. And tell them, here are your
parameters.
Evaluation parameters for what you do with a given murder.
But I would say, I mean, for somebody who, that's the most innocent of human beings. So if somebody knowingly goes in and knows that it's a human being and willingly, no outside reasoning whatsoever, other than I want to keep my beach body for this summer and I'm going into the summer, capital punishment. Like I think everything should be on the table, and we should be able to, we need to reform maybe how we elect our judges, and so that we know that they're trustworthy and they're going to adjudicate these things rightly. But I do think you have to have the full width, because there are some very evil women out there, and all you got to do is get on TikTok or Instagram and find them who fully aware of what they're doing.
Let's stay on this briefly. Welcome Beverly to the program this morning. Good morning, Beverly.
Good morning, and I have a question for you all, and I will preface it with, I think all three of you know, I made that choice. I have a 38-year-old son, and I've never been married. And it was a very difficult choice, and it was not great circumstances.
Yeah.
But my question with all this, and I hear what y'all are all saying, but my question with this is, so who proves rape and incest?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're going to get to that one, Beverly, because that's an important question that the law has to ask and it has to account for. One claim made by... I'm going to call them abolitionists, okay, because those are the terms that we're using, abolitionists versus incrementalists. That's kind of the fault line between this issue, is that, as you mentioned, when we passed the Born Alive Infant Protection Act back in the early 2000s, we didn't attach a criminal penalty to it.
Yes,
and the point being there that if you don't attach a criminal penalty, there's not
adequate
friction.
There's no motivating factor.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sting to the law, and so you don't have any reason not to do that activity. So if we definitionally define abortion as murder and say that's a human life you're taking.
Somebody pointed out on Facebook, I appreciate you guys are looking at American legal scenarios. This is Christian worldview. Would somebody say clearly what the Bible says? Well, I mean, murder is murder. Doesn't really matter what your circumstances are. And so that's why, and that's my whole basis, because I tried to be, my foundation for policy and for life is the scripture. And the scriptures call murder, murder. And that's why I think that our justice system here in the United States is so beautiful, is because we can make universal statements here in the United States, such as stealing is wrong, lying is wrong, murder is wrong, and all of those things, and we can have a law of the land that upholds the truth of God's scripture and upholds the value that he places on human life, and then allow the circumstances of a murder or a theft to be adjudicated by a judge. Now, of course, our judges are very important, and we have seen...
And imperfect.
And we have seen many cases, even in just recent history, where a judge has ruled wrongly in our opinions. And you could be on the left or the right or whoever, and you would look at a situation and say, I believe that they judged wrongly.
Right.
But at least we have a justice system that allows and would bring, that brings depth. Because, see, the law of the land There are some things that supersede circumstances that should be overarching. And murder, lying, theft, all of those things are a part of that overarching that just, you know what, as a country, we condemn these things. And of course, my belief is because it's grounded in the Word of God.
Of course.
But we condemn these things overarching. And then you allow your justice system to allow to put breadth and depth on that and what it means and what the consequences of those things and those wrong choices would be. And so we have a broken justice system because we have broken, we're broken human beings. And we have a more and more broken justice system because we are day by day getting further and further away from God's word and a Christian morality as a nation. And so it's very hard for us to, unless there, and this comes back to something that you and I are both very passionate about. It comes down to, we have to have spiritual revival. We really do. If you want these things to really and truly be adjudicated the way that they should be without having a hardcore law on every single nuance of life, because that's what we're trying to get into. Because once you start saying we're going to have to, you know, really specify how, okay, a girl who's been raped who's 14 or a girl who has an abortion and she's 18 and she's fully aware, like once you get all into
our
all
our laws
of those,
are going to have to be hundreds and hundreds of pages long
and
to account for all that legalistic technicalities.
Yes, and you know, and I forget which founding father it was, forgive me, Madison maybe?
Adams.
Mm-hmm. Who just said, you know, when we have to make these laws that are so convoluted, they do not benefit the people. And I forget the exact quote.
And that wasn't the quote that I was thinking of, but it's basically the conscience or the constable, that a person who will not be governed by anyone, who can't govern themselves, now, won't be governed by another.
Well, it was Madison who I believe, who made the point that, and I've talked about it on my podcast at some point recently, mm-hmm. who talked about the fact that, look, if our laws become so convoluted, if they become so difficult for the common man to understand, they do not benefit the citizenry at all, and they become onerous and burdensome. And that's exactly what this is, what is happening here in the United States, is that our laws, because we are no longer a moral people, we no longer have a scriptural biblical foundation, because when we do, we govern ourselves,
yes.
and we don't need the legal system to, and so
account for all these
so
technicalities.
So then the question then becomes, okay, well, are we going to, because we're not a moral people, do we have to up the ante with our laws? Do we have to begin to attempt to micromanage people's lives?
How do you answer that
and
question?
My answer for that would be no. I think we still have overarching principles. I think we still allow the justice system to function as it's supposed to. And then you and I as believers do the very best we can to evangelize.
So that's a super important point. I'm glad you said all that, Hannah, because that illustrates kind of one of the major differences, I think, between abolitionists and incrementalists, is that abolitionists are very idealistic in their view of the justice system. And incrementalists they use words like practical realities. So you say that we need revival in America. Well, practical realities being what they are, we live in a morally broken country. And so we have to act as if we live in a morally broken country. We can't act as if we have already experienced the spiritual renewal that you're...
Yeah, I get your point, too, with that. But the reality is that when it does come down to it, is murder wrong? Because the thing is when we're going to try to... have all of these exceptions for murder, where are all of our exceptions for theft? Where are all of our exceptions for lying or lying in court or, you know, under where we are now going to have to adjudicate all of these things, and we're going to have to make exceptions for all of these things. And then our laws that are already so burdensome and difficult to navigate become even more difficult to navigate. And so I think, you know, I just think that we cannot go down that road, because that's a dangerous road to go down, because then you're looking at China. I mean, that's what tyranny is when you're when you go down that road.
Micromanaging people's moral realities day to day.
And you really cannot allow your government, because then what happens? Spiritual revival is not allowed. That's what's happened with China. I mean, that's what these countries that begin down the road of micromanaging eventually end up where they do not allow for freedom of religion. And we have to have freedom of religion for there to be you don't have to have one for revival, because revival's happening in countries all across the world who don't have it. But to really take a hold of a nation and be able to turn our country around, it would behoove us to preserve freedom of religion. And we won't get there by allowing our government to become bigger and bigger and bigger.
Practical realities being what they are, I use that phrase a lot, the law has been lying to people for 50 years now. It has lied to two generations of women. It has told them that it is okay to kill your baby, and then it hasn't even used those words. It says that it's okay to end your pregnancy. They've defined that differently for 50 years. Now you're saying that we need to snap back to moral sanity. But is there a component at which we start by defining life correctly?
Well, we've been doing that for 50 years. And I think that's why...
Not in the law.
Well, the law never...
But the law is a teacher, and the law has taught the moral imagination. It has informed the moral imagination.
That's where you're wrong about Roe v. Wade. It was never law. It was an opinion.
Well, but it has
never passed into...
But that's idealistic. That's not practical,
into law with Congress.
Right.
These people, they have been lied to, but it was not the law. And so now we are getting into technicalities. But the truth is out there, and these women... Even if, you know, just because the government is sitting up there and Joe Biden spouts all kinds of lies all of the time, it doesn't make it true and it doesn't make it right. And it doesn't mean that I should put blinders on my eyes and just believe it. And it doesn't mean that there are not consequences for believing a lie. Look, if your child comes to you and the law of the land in your house is X, and they believe something different and they defy the law of the land in your house, are there still consequences for it?
Well, there ignorance is no excuse.
Yes,
right?
Ignorance is no excuse. And I think that that's true for the scriptures. Ignorance is no... The Lord does not give us an excuse for not coming to salvation. Even for men who... And now we're getting into real theology here. Even for those who do not have the word of God. He says, look all around you. There's natural revelation. All of man who's ever been born has a reason to believe there is a God. You do not have an excuse for not coming to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. And so if he can say that, ignorance is no excuse, then I can look at a woman and say, your ignorance is no excuse, because it's willful ignorance in the 21st century when we have so much information at our fingertips.
I think that we need to get creative in sentencing women, and particularly versus, though we define it as murder, we define abortion as murder definitionally, and then in terms of the criminal consequences, the sentencing, what do you think of the idea of sentencing her to a regimen of morally formative classes? Like, if you get an abortion and you're a woman...
I don't trust our justice system or our government to know what moral...
What if it was a public-private partnership?
I think you could have those discussions. I don't trust anything that the government is involved in to be not morally tainted. Because our government in the 21st century, their foundation is not biblical. It would not be what you and I would agree. I don't think you and I would agree with what they would see as moral. And so I think what you end up having is, and this is probably where you're kind of leaning, is some sort of partnership with a church or a Christian organization or a crisis pregnancy center.
Certainly open to that.
Something like that.
Yeah. Some
that
stakeholder
have,
in the life
yes,
industry.
That would have a say, you know, even if it was like CPS, like as far as, you know, foster care programs or whatever, that would have some sort of say in helping to educate these or influence these women. You could have those arguments. I think that they're...
Do you see what I'm doing, though? I'm trying to match the sentence to the crime.
Yeah, sure. And I think that's what is the responsibility of a judge. And I think a judge, you know, that's why they determine that some people need to go to a psych ward versus need to go to a prison.
Exactly.
And so that is their responsibility, to be able to look at all of the data that you and I don't have. You know, people investigate this, they investigate that, they bring all the information. The judge looks at all of it. They hear the opinions, they hear the arguments, and then... they adjudicate whether, you know, okay, was this just a cold-blooded murder, or was this, there was so many, you know, mitigating circumstances that this was a very difficult situation for a very vulnerable woman, and we need to have some leniency here. There is certainly arguments that needs to happen.
It's so hard to find situations that are analogous,
though. If it doesn't happen, though, then we have a problem with our justice system, and we need to be pursuing... that there be, according to the scriptures, a balance of weights in the justice system, because that's what needs to happen. And it's a bitter thing. It's a sour thing. I forget what exactly the words are in scripture. When there is not even weights and a balance of weight.
Abomination, I think it
uses
the word.
Yes, I think maybe it's abomination, depending on your version.
In the old King James, it says abomination.
Abomination. That's right. So that's where we need to be very careful. And so you look at the, you know, when you're looking at things like the war on drugs and you're looking at somebody who, there are certain situations where somebody needs very strict consequences and somebody doesn't need
intervention.
They need intervention. Mm-hmm. And so we have a justice system that tends to err on the side of very strict consequences.
Put people in cages.
Instead mm-hmm. of intervention and instead of helping, we're making that move. I think our generation's very aware of that problem with our justice system, and that definitely needs to be pursued. But it doesn't mean that we don't look at what's going on and say it's wrong. It means we need to better adjudicate these situations, and we need to have better options for women who are in vulnerable situations. And it may not necessarily be a, like, we're going to...
murder one, go to jail for 10 years.
Yes, exactly. We could spend all day talking about how different situations could be adjudicated when it comes to this situation.
But can we have the flexibility, since the sentencing flexibility? That needs to be built into the law, is to account for those mitigating factors.
You could build that into the law. It could be a part of it. I think it's kind of a known factor with the in the United States that should always be a part of due process. That should always be a part of how things are adjudicated.
I think that needs to be made explicit, though, because the anti-life crowd.
And it could be that to appease them. We're going to criminalize all abortions across the board, whatever your no circumstance, no exceptions whatsoever.
Because
but
that's
very
what's
clearly,
morally right.
Because that's what's morally right, and uh-huh. murder is murder. Mm-hmm. And if we do anything less, we devalue the human life that's being taken. But build into the bill that there has to be a correct adjudication for the mitigating circumstances.
That is fascinating. With rape, okay, for example, mm-hmm. Beverly's question. There's a charge of rape that's leveled. How do you then adjudicate that? You know, because mm-hmm. there has to be an investigation. It's mm-hmm. he said, it's she said. How do you,
right.
or even with chemical abortions accounting mm-hmm. for most abortions right now, I didn't have an abortion, I had a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. How do you get into those situations? Then you're into forensics, you're doing
right.
an investigation.
And people would say, well, now we're wasting all this money on doing this investigating. And to that I would say, look, you can suspect all you want, but if there's no hardcore evidence for somebody who's had an actual abortion versus saying that they had a miscarriage, then the justice system is just, or the investigator is just going to look at that and say, look, we all believe 100% that this was an abortion and not a miscarriage, but there's no evidence and I can't do anything. And there's lots of situations where that's happened in the United States. And we don't just keep relentlessly pursuing it and trying to prove something and pin something on somebody with absolutely no evidence.
What are the pros and cons kind of that
and
approach?
The pros and cons of, you know, trying to say, well, now we've got, what was Beverly's exact question? Because that's what
if there's a rape.
The proving of that,
right.
and now we're wasting resources. I think maybe that's where she was trying to get. Well, the con of that would be, okay, it feels like we're wasting time. I think that's going to be difficult to prove. The pro of that is that rapists' number one thing. I mean, what's in their corner the most is abortion. Because that they eradicate all evidence of their crime with that. And so if you – now, again, do you know the number of rapes is very small. The number of actual pregnancies that occur due to rape is also very, very, very small.
Well,
and
it would
so,
be a portion,
so
only a portion
yes,
of the number of rapes.
Which
We're
is
not
a,
trying to minimize
No,
this.
No, which is a terrible, so, terrible crime.
Right.
I want those guys to – if it's – you know, if it happened and it's provable, I want them to go to the end of the law. I want us to throw the book at them,
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
And so abortion is a way that they're able to kind of hide their crime. And the other
so
thing,
it's
again,
in the
it
rapist's
comes down to
interest to abort the baby.
It is.
It is against their interest because then we have evidence and we can do DNA
yes,
testing and
exactly.
all that.
And again, going back to the justice system, we have thousands of rape kits on backlog. Why is that? We need to pursue that. And that's one of the ways that we, you know, we can prove. And that's when people say, well, rapes happen all the time and they're not proven. That's because a lot of times we're not pursuing these rape kits. We're not looking at these things. We're not investigating. And we need to be doing that so that we can rightly adjudicate these situations.
I've so appreciated your willingness to come on and have what's a difficult conversation. These are necessary,
yeah.
important conversations between people who are on the same side and
right.
think of things differently. Would you plug your podcast real quickly before we go?
Yeah, sure. If you liked anything that I said today, you can find my show, The Hannah Miller Show. It's in wherever you listen to podcasts, you can subscribe. And
what
and
did you talk about on your most recent episode?
Well, tomorrow's episode is going to actually be an update on COVID. I've not talked about that in months.
And I
so
wanted to
I'm
today, and
to,
we didn't get to it.
Yeah, So I cover a bunch of new information with COVID and then children and the FDA and their approval of the third of a booster for them and the WHO and the Biden administration and what they're doing. So
it was a real delight to have you on. Let's
Thanks
do it
so
again
much.
Sometime. All right. We will be back on Monday. You're going to have to go 3 days without us. I don't know how you're going to do it, but we trust you. We'll see you on Monday.